Previously on Forever Chemicals.
We heard from brands like Outdoor Research, Nemo Equipment, and Mystery Ranch regarding their efforts in phasing out PFAS from their products, some challenges they faced in the process, and how we can move forward with more intention in the future.
If I start with what is PFAS? PFAS is a very big group of fluororganic chemicals and polymers. They have what are called extraordinary properties.
PFAS are industrial chemicals, and the carbon-fluorine bond is perhaps the strongest in the periodic table. It takes the energy of lightning to break it.
PFAS are known as forever chemicals.
The chemical industry knew that PFAS could be harmful.
So it's used in places that folks don't think. It's in every pizza box that you've gotten a pizza in. It's in your coffee cup at your favorite coffee joint around the corner. It's in cosmetics. You know, it's everywhere.
PFAS chemicals are wreaking havoc on our health and environment.
It's a really serious issue.
So there's health impacts and there are environmental impacts.
So many of them have been found to last essentially on geologic time.
Difficult to remove, difficult to filter, and then once removed and filtered, difficult to dispose of. They have been found to bioaccumulate in people and animals and have been found in almost every living creature on Earth.
We need to eliminate our apparent appetite for using PFAS.
The environmental impacts are pretty potent. Many of us refer to these as forever chemicals.
Forever chemicals. Forever chemicals. Forever chemicals. Forever chemicals.
I think that companies working and struggling with this issue have to be serious about their approach. I think the ultimate aim for every company involved is to eliminate the use of PFAS. And if they cannot do that, they should have a very good reason why they can't do it. A very good narrative and technical scientific data why you can't phase out PFAS. That's my message. Don't just sit there and say, oh, it's so convenient to use PFAS, we can't blah, blah. No BS. Sorry, but scientific basis. That's the only way.
It seems that many brands are moving in the right direction in terms of phasing PFAS out of their production. But one of the many aspects complicating this process is the potential for contamination.
We are continuing to find, and we have now solved, a significant number of areas where PFAS was somewhere, you know, and I'm going to be careful, intentionally added or unintentionally. We weren't aware it was there as the brand, as the manufacturer, but it was intentionally added somewhere along in the supply chain. I think two examples I'll give you that we have to work through really complicated. Number one is some membranes are created with PFAS used as a lubricant in some of the production processes of said membranes. That means some of those membranes either won't perform the same or won't be able to be used. That's going to dramatically alter the landscape of waterproof breathables. Number two, release agents and related processing steps. It's a fairly well-known public thing now that YKK, one of the leading manufacturers of zippers in the world and a huge partner of OR for the record, they make some of the best waterproof zippers out there. It turns out it wasn't in the waterproof parts and pieces. It was in the enamel that they were using to paint and color some of their zippers and metal parts. And we're now seeing enamel as another area where there's been issues. We had no idea. Do you know how many of those zippers are used across the entire industry, even on C0-based garments? There was a good chunk of production that in theory could have, would have, or is failing the testing because of the zippers. So even if like the fabric, and we did a great job, it's in buttons, it's in trims, it's in zippers, it's in snaps, it's in all these other substrates. Think about your jacket and all the pieces and parts in it. I think that was a huge realization for us of like, this isn't just about the fabrics that we know of. It has to be everything.
Outdoor Research wasn't the only brand that experienced issues with contamination or found surprises in terms of where they found PFAS in their products. Even after Keen had phased PFAS out of their production, their testing discovered PFAS contaminating products through their packaging.
PFAS never really, it doesn't go away, as I'm sure that you know and are hearing from a lot of folks that you're interviewing. It lasts thousands of years. It's literally everywhere. So back in 20 or 21, we were getting positive PFAS test results in some of our finished good testing. And we were like, how is this happening? You know, we've been PFAS free for a few years now. And it was because of cross-contamination, like you're suggesting. So like printing receipts or shipping receipts that were being printed and added to shoeboxes for finished goods or shipping boxes contained PFAS so that the ink didn't smudge. And so there was a cross-contamination issue happening on a finished good product. And I mean, think about like where containers come from, you know, where a lot of folks are shipping footwear, apparel from the same places to the same places in the same containers. And, you know, are they all getting cleaned each time a new shipment of shoes or jackets or whatever it is moving? So there's definitely always a threat of cross-contamination.
The extensive use in production and ability PFAS has to travel creates even more potential for contamination in manufacturing.
There's a lot of chemicals and catalysts used in producing fibers, membranes, and fabrics. That's three very different things in most cases, that are used in process steps. They're used as catalysts. They're used as release agents in some senses. Think injection molded plastic, you know, tri-glides, side release buckles, snap covers. Those are made in a mold, and there usually is something that doesn't have high friction coefficient, something that resists being stuck, a release agent, so that when they mold those buckles, gajillions of them an hour, they come out of the mold more easily. And in many cases, Teflon and PFAS was great for that. A lot of those agents are usually intended to be removed through additional processing or processing steps later, to where you might find those trace elements. That's why the industry is kind of worried about contamination right now, contamination background, which is driving some of the language and some of the regulatory actions around the word intentionally added. You know, the other thing that I think people don't always think through, you think about like Scotch guarding your jeans when you were a kid. I don't know if you spent time in the Midwest, like maybe I did, but that's in a can, right? It's aerosolized. You just spray that stuff right on what you wanted to. Most DWRs in the outdoor industry, they're applied during the dye process. It's actually mixed directly into the dye in certain dye applications. That also then means that there are secondary benefits to having that DWR in the dye stuff, either in cleaning of the machines, in the actual application, or the spray consistency through the nozzles. DWR is used in lots of interesting or these types of chemicals of secondary applications. Back to your favorite down puffy, there's a couple famous stories where folks would change from a C6-based fluorinated to a non-fluorinated, exact same fabric, exact same dye recipe, exact same everything, remove the fluorinated chemistries, and the garments had a huge down leakage problem. The only variable other than the ones you have a hard time controlling, which is we made it last year, we made it this year, they fully isolated and believe that whatever those early non-fluorinated DWR chemicals, it caused the garments to leak down.
Since contamination is such an issue and seems nearly impossible to avoid, certain regulations, like those in California banning PFAS in textiles, do allow for low levels of contamination to occur.
So California has left a little bit of breathing room to account for the contamination issue. They set a threshold that is based on a test of 100 parts per million of what's called total organic fluorine. We're doing a lot of test result evaluation for clients right now, guiding testing programs and protocols for clients. And we are seeing quite a few of the tests come back with below 100 parts per million. And so that does indicate that, yes, indeed, there is some contamination that's happening because these are very difficult chemicals to clean from manufacturing processes. So if company A goes first and they are okay having PFAS in their products, company B goes second, there's likely to be contamination. But the law does account for very low levels of contamination.
Without proper oversight and guidance to ensure a product is compliant under new regulations, knowing if a product is PFAS-free or free of intentionally added PFAS can feel impossible.
The cross-contamination is another vector that you can end up with PFAS in your product because PFAS is so ubiquitous. We're not simply just talking about DWR or even membranes. We're talking about it could be in dye stuff. It could be in powder coating. It could be in paints. It could be in a whole host of other things that require or have for years had PFAS as a part of its formulation. And so there's two parts to this. One is really know those formulations and really understand what goes into creating those formulations. And that's one thing that we do very well because we are working very closely with those who are making these chemistries and know everything that's going into those chemistries. And so that's a huge part of that. The other thing is working with better suppliers, suppliers who are aware of these issues and acknowledge that PFAS might be in a lubricant, or it might be in a process chemical that is being used in their organization. And so you know, a Blue Sign facility, a facility that has gone through the Blue Sign process, is by nature going to be a much better facility that is much more aware of all the things that it needs to be managed. So, you know, one of the things I tell a lot of organizations is, you know, you absolutely want to ensure the chemistry is not PFAS based, so water repellency or what have you, but also make sure you're working with good suppliers because they're going to be way better at doing that.
As brands work to move away from PFAS and transition to what many brands are calling C0 chemistry, in many cases, it was up to them to collaborate with their suppliers and work together to figure out how to make a product PFAS-free.
We have fantastic Japanese suppliers for our shell layers, and we had been working with them for a long, long time to move from linear to circular, meaning that we have recycled fibers going into the fabrics, and then making monomaterial design so that those fibers can go back into recycling and be used again for new textiles. And that's textile to textile recycling then. And they were using PFAS in their DWRs, not in the membranes. It was a polyester membrane, which is how we could design monomaterial circular, but they were using PFAS. We could have moved to another factory or other factories, other suppliers, and do a quick fix to the PFAS problem that we had. We would then move from circular back to linear. So we decided together with our partners to support them on the journey. It took a few more months, but we could remain partners with our circular design intact. At that time, it might sound like a given, but at that time, Greenpeace was really active in criticizing our industry, which I think they did absolutely right in doing. So you might say it was a risk from our side to not just switch to PFAS-free because nobody cared at the time about circularity. But we didn't do that. We stayed true to our values and to the science that we know was right, staying with circular and taking a few more months to move from PFAS to PFAS-free. And when we talked to Greenpeace about this, they were absolutely agreeing with us. So there's sometimes less risk than you think about doing the right thing and taking the proper time in order to move towards a better alternative.
As more regulation goes into effect in the next few years, especially in the United States, brands may find that the contamination issue is difficult to clearly communicate to their consumers or even identify in their own supply chains.
If you see a product that's labeled, say, PFOA-free or PFAS-free, PFOS, that should be a warning sign to you that there's a good chance that that product contains another PFAS chemical. And you should reach out to the manufacturer or retailer and say, hey, I saw this label on your product. What are you using instead? Are you using other PFAS chemicals? Because I would say 9 times out of 10, if you see a product labeled PFOA-free or PFOS-free, there's a very good chance that they have replaced it with another substitute, which may be just as persistent and might be just as toxic. What we call that in the industry is a regrettable substitute.
This is really the core of my work right now, relates to understanding how to restrict PFAS inputs in your supply chain, effectively communicate with suppliers, and mandate these kinds of changes to products. It's a huge challenge for folks, especially because of how pervasive these chemicals are in the supply chains and in traditional manufacturing processes. And there are kind of two reasons, or maybe even three reasons, to go about it. One is that it's good. You might want to phase out these things. You may want to make claims about the healthfulness of your product or the environmental impact of your products. There might be a benefit both to the environment and to your consumers and consumer interest. Another reason to do this is the regulatory environment is changing. There are state bans going into effect in the next few years, and state bans that are already in effect in a number of states related to products throughout the outdoor industry. A third reason relates to these greenwashing claims. If you want to be making sustainability claims about your products, about your company, you will want to make sure that you have the backing to make that claim, what we call substantiation. As far as methods to go about it, there are a number of different ways that people go about this. Testing is certainly one piece of the puzzle, and you'll often hear folks talk about testing. The challenge with testing for a chemical like PFAS is that we've been talking about PFAS as though it's one thing. It's actually so many different chemicals within this family. And that presents a pretty unique challenge from a testing perspective. You can test for individual PFAS and say something is PFOA-free, for instance, which is one PFAS chemical, one of these older legacy PFAS chemicals that's been pretty much phased out worldwide. That chemical, which there's very clear scientific evidence, is harmful to human health and the environment. That's one of up to 13,000 PFAS chemicals. So testing for that can only get you so far. Testing for 50 chemicals can only get you so far if you happen to have the 51st in your product. So trying to figure out test methods that get at the entire family and tell you something meaningful about the PFAS content of your product is a huge challenge. There have been test methods developed for fluorine as a screening method. The challenge is that fluorine exists in other forms than PFAS. Fluorinated water, just to give one example out there. But fluorine tests or organic fluorine tests, which we're still developing test methods for in many ways, that provides one potential avenue to ensure phase out and to make those kinds of claims with confidence. Other methods are through things like a restricted substance list, having a list of substances that you've phased out and you communicate those things clearly to your suppliers through contracts and through checking, often verification through testing, third-party testing. A restricted substance list can provide a really useful tool to communicate clear guidelines to your suppliers and then embedding that into your contracts. So what if something comes up positive? How are you going to address those things? What tools do you have in place to return the product, to deal with the product, to remediate, to make sure that it doesn't happen again in the future? These are all huge challenges for the industry, especially with such complex supply chains and often international supply chains as well.
Keen is an excellent example of a brand that implemented effective testing protocols, not only for PFAS, but for the six classes of harmful chemicals.
We have a fairly robust testing protocol. So we test basically the first requirement of doing business with Keen or of supplying Keen a material for, you know, one of the hundreds of things that it could be is to sign our RSL and code of conduct and, you know, basically say, if you want to do business with Keen, you have to make sure that you're adhering to these standards. And one of them is that whatever it is that we're purchasing can't contain PFAS. So we test before we purchase any new materials for any components. Like the material supplier has to provide a third-party verification test that says that it complies with our policy. And then we do sort of random, we call it trust and verify. So we do random component testing, and then we do random finished good testing as well. And that's all year, every season. It's sort of just on a rotating timeline. Our RSL follows the AFIRM guidelines, which is kind of like an industry standard set of guidelines. And then we sort of extend our policy to also include these six chemical classes.
Keen's testing framework is fairly common across the industry, but how effective it is highly dependent on how rigorously the brand follows these procedures. So while Keen may be doing a great job, it's because they care. Other brands may implement and use similar processes, but they may not be testing as much or as often. It's also worth noting that, as we learned in previous episodes, a lot of these changes and frameworks come due to regulation and legislation. What we're seeing now in the industry is intensive and rigorous testing for PFAS specifically, but that likely was not the case before the widespread phase-out due to regulatory changes. And some brands, like Keen, are likely testing for more than just PFAS and are following a rigorous restricted substances list, which includes the six classes of harmful chemicals.
Tens of thousands of industrial chemicals, and to regulate just one chemical can take years of scientific research and advocacy. And when a chemical is regulated, it's quite expensive to change manufacturing processes. So the chemical industry is likely to come up with what's called a drop-in replacement, which will be similar in structure, function. What do you think? Will it be similar in toxicity? Yes. And that's called a regrettable substitute. And then after more years of research and advocacy, this chemical is also found to be toxic. And then there's another one similar in structure, function, and toxicity. And that goes on and on. So a group of scientists, business people, government people got together to think, what can we do about this? We know there are these harmful chemicals in everyday products. We're exposed. And we realized that there's six classes or families that make up the majority of the harmful chemicals. And if you think of the whole class at once, you can solve it. And so for PFAS, it's particularly relevant. And I will say, we originally thought this was good for manufacturers, that government wouldn't be able to do whole classes, but they are, which is fantastic. And they are regulating the whole class of PFAS. The other five classes are antimicrobials, which are way overused, especially since the pandemic. Things that kill microbes aren't good for people, and we should only use them if they're necessary. Flame retardants, again, used way more than they should be when they're not helpful. Bisphenols and phthalates, you know, water bottles, but you know, they went from bisphenol A to bisphenol S, which is not an improvement. So you want to think of the whole class, certain solvents and certain metals. So those are the six classes.
Beyond the issue of contamination, what do we do with all of the PFAS-laden products that have already been created? Do these pose a risk for further contamination and pollution?
Well, disposal is a big issue. What do you do with this stuff? Maybe there should be take-back campaigns, because what do you do with your PFAS jacket? You put it in a landfill. And ultimately, maybe it breaks down into harmful chemicals that end up in landfill leachate, end up back in the world. So I think disposal is a problem that needs to be addressed.
The safest thing you can do in most cases is continue to use your garment like you would to the end of life. As soon as you throw it in a landfill and say, it's going to cause me harm, it's potentially entering into a stream of ecology to where it could get into the groundwater, it gets into the landfill, you know, et cetera. It gets incinerated and then is released in its gaseous form. So it's safe if you have this jacket in your closet. Keep using it. That's actually the smartest, safest thing you could do with it until we're presented with some form of additional evidence to the contrary.
PFAS's ability to migrate and then attach to products or organisms makes controlling it and cleaning it up a huge challenge. This is why many experts have been pushing for the elimination of PFAS from production. But we still have all the old PFAS to worry about as well.
And unfortunately, we've already seen that over the decades, the contamination has spread. So it's becoming more complex, more expensive, the more time that passes. I think that we need, of course, some agreement on how to proceed in regard to the past exposures, because we are all exposed to PFAS only in part from our current consumption, consumer products, et cetera, contaminated food, contaminated drinking water. Some of that PFAS is old. It is something that was produced and disseminated decades ago. We're still exposed to that. So we need two efforts. One is to control and limit and remove the old PFAS, but we also need to be responsible for the new sources of PFAS, some of which will possibly enter our food and drinking water from now on. And I see a great hesitation happening where certain producers are claiming that their particular use of PFAS, let's say in microelectronics or in the windmill industry, solar panels. I mean, there are some keywords like that. They claim that the use of PFAS is essential. Just because a company claims that because the PFAS is rather inexpensive, perhaps, I don't think that we should necessarily agree to that, because I'm aware, this is what chemists are telling me, that there are alternatives that are not as toxic as PFAS.
So the only way to stop this increase is to stop using PFAS. That's the only way. No input of PFAS in any value chain, in any production. If that is realistic to 100%, I'm not so sure about that. But we have this approach in the European Union, some advertising, to remove at least 95%, and most are non-essential uses, where PFAS are really not necessary to use from a performance perspective. Those exemptions discussed are protective gear for, let's say, firefighters, first responders, or workers in very heavy and dirty chemical industry, you have this filtration separation system where you work in a highly microbiological contaminated environment. This kind of considerations, but not the consumer side. It's really hard to find something where it would be essential or necessary, if I can use that word, because that would mean that the risk is unacceptable in that environment without PFAS for your health, for your safety. And actually, I haven't identified that yet, not my colleagues either.
The burden of knowing whether a product contains PFAS or not should not fall onto the consumer. But in many cases, that's exactly what is happening. So how can we know if what we are buying does or does not have PFAS in it?
It is very hard to say they're 100% PFAS-free, but we can proudly say that we have been working with phasing everything out since 2009 or 8 or whatever we started, I don't know, something like that. And we have been through heavy testing. We have been through a lot of changes in our supply chain. We have been through a lot of tests, and the tests are developing, and we have learned a lot. So we are in the forefront. And as we speak, we are just some trims away from being, if we would test our entire assortment today, I would say, yeah, we are very much PFAS-free. But then 6 months later, maybe a test has been developed and we will find something somewhere. But as far as we can go at the moment, and I just want to say, I'm also very proud of the fact that this has been done without knowing that there are laws coming in place in the near future. We have done that because we believe that that was the right way, which is something we try to strive for all the time, to be better than legislations and better than laws and regulations. So,
because it's easy to put a label on something.
Mm-hmm.
That we know. How can you? How do you know that it's truly PFAS-free? I think you have to think as a consumer, but I think the consumers are so much smarter these days. I think we need to give everybody a little bit more credit that most of the consumers that really look into outdoor brands and also to, they actually look into brands. And I think by looking into a brand and understanding what is important to that brand gets you closer to having trust, because it's so hard to just put a label on everything and just walk away. And sometimes the labels are as good as the, you know, material is printed on. It may not be the truth. So I think we have to form trust with our consumers. We have to be, or brands ourselves, we have to be trustworthy partners in this journey. And at the end of the day, you're not going to hide behind any label. You're not going to hide behind any blue sign or, you know, all of these labels that you can buy into that are going to be the golden ticket. And that Woolke helped me with many, many, many years ago, that the labels are cheating. The labels are the quick way, and you have to do the work. And I think it's important to do the work. So for me, if I'm as a consumer, I look at brands, and if I see a bunch of labels, that makes me less confident. If I dig deep into it and somehow trust the brand and see that they're doing the work. And I think, you know, podcasts like yours are helpful because it helps with the research, and it's helped to, from a brand's perspective, to also communicate what to do with the work that actually has to be done in order to really get there. So I'm sorry to say, we have to form trust.
The work we're doing now, helping prevent the use of PFAS and other classes of harmful chemicals, is very reminiscent to me of Himalayan expeditions, because you have a summit, you gather a team, you're roped together on a Himalayan expedition. If somebody slips and falls, you can all fall. Along the way, there's going to be storms and avalanches and route finding problems and an occasional Yeti that pops up. And it's a little bit similar with what we're doing now. I think we're all working together. The summit, you know, is a healthier world with reduced toxics. And it's very similar, I think, where it's hard work. You find a route, things change, there are storms and there are avalanches. So anyway, so I feel really fortunate, as I have gotten a bit old, to do Himalayan mountaineering expeditions, to get to do expeditions towards healthier products, healthier people, and healthier planet. So it's good you're doing your series and good the world is discovering that they don't need PFAS and indeed other harmful chemicals.
As consumers, we may not be able to shop our way out of this problem, but there are resources available to help us make more intentional choices.
Go to our website, sixclasses.org. They'll find things that they can do, how to recognize, because the big problem is recognizing, is it in your products? You know, so if something, at least till now, if it's stain repellent, waterproof, likely has PFAS, or if you see those words or fluoro, so you can learn how to identify where these chemicals are likely to be, and you can not buy them, or better yet, you can write the manufacturers and say, we prefer to buy products without harmful chemicals. I mean, people don't have a lot of time to do that, but if they occasionally do it, it's helpful. But I don't think people can shop their way out of this. I think it needs to come from government regulators, from manufacturers. And we have found that when educated, a lot of companies will make a better choice and stop using PFAS and other harmful classes of chemicals. And that's very promising because I think it's more up to the manufacturers and the retailers than consumers to try to keep track of that whole complexity.
The push to remove PFAS from consumer goods has been slow, but recently appears fast-tracked by upcoming regulations. Regardless, much of the responsibility for this problem should be left to the producers and government regulators to ensure that what we buy, consume, and are exposed to is truly safe and free of harmful chemicals, whether they're intentionally added or not. It seems that in the case of PFAS, there may be a light at the end of the tunnel. And in the next episode, we explore alternatives, their effectiveness, and how we should use PFAS as a cautionary tale for the future. If you want to learn more about what PFAS are, where they're found, the proven health effects, how you can limit your exposure, up-to-date news on PFAS, and how to get involved in PFAS regulatory efforts, visit toxicfreefuture.org, foodandwaterwatch.org, or PFAScentral.org. SnapLink Consulting provided expert fact-checking and guidance for the creation of this podcast. SnapLink Consulting provides corporate sustainability strategies and ESG support across a broad range of industries, including apparel, footwear, home furnishings, software, cosmetics, professional services, and more. Head to snaplinkconsulting.com to learn more and contact the experts to guide you through complex topics like CSRD, PFAS, greenhouse gas assessments, SBTI, CDP, EcoVadis, B Corp, and many more compliance and certification frameworks. Forever Chemicals is a Blackfooted Ferret production. All the source material for this episode can be found in the show notes or at theoutdoorminimalist.com/foreverchemicals. As an independent podcast, we rely on listener support as our primary avenue for funding. If you like this show and our other content, consider donating to our GoFundMe. The link is in the show notes.